Hey, this is Duray, and welcome to Boss Save the People. Happy Women's History Month. And we are back to cover the underreported news with regard to race, justice, equity, and what's going on in the world. And this week, our guest news contributor is Sharonda Bossier. She's a thought leader who started her career in education as a public school teacher and is now the CEO of Education Leaders of Color. She's a lifelong organizer, incredible woman. You will love her. And she really pushed me to think about some things differently this week. And our interview is with none other than the author Nick Stone. Nick is just such an incredible young adult author, just amazing. Her newest book, Dear Manny, just came out. It's the third and final installment of the young adult fiction series that started with Dear Martin. Here we go. Trump's address to Congress was the longest in history because, of course, it was. But beneath the 100-minute spectacle was the same dangerous rhetoric on immigration, crime, and trans rights. So what do we do now? On the latest episode of Assembly Required, Stacey Abrams is joined by Jen Psaki, host of MSNBC's Inside with Jen Psaki, and The Blueprint to break it all down, strategize how Democrats and all of us can push back, and prepare for the chaos ahead. Listen to Assembly Required now. New episodes drop every Thursday wherever you get your podcasts or on YouTube. Okay, we are back. There's a lot that went on in the past week, and we are excited to have another voice on the podcast. This is Duray at DRAY on Twitter.
This is Miles E. Johnson at Feral Rapture on Instagram.
And I'm Sharonda Bossier. You can find me on LinkedIn if you are also still stuck in the bad place there.
Are you really off socials?
I really am off socials. Honestly, like, I've known for a long time that the people who own those companies and platforms don't share my values, but watching them pal around with Trump was really the end of it for me. And it was about reclaiming my attention span and also just trying to be more intentional about, like, building real relationships with my friends. I was using social media as a passive way to pretend to still be in people's lives, and I wasn't. And so just even the stuff that I talk about with my childhood best friends on Instagram is very different than what I talk with them about on, like, other ways of communication. So it shifted fundamentally my relationships with people I care about. So it's been the right move.
Miles, are you staying on?
I am slowly bleeding off. I feel like sometimes, because my relationship with X is that very similar to, like, a crack addict's relationship with crack cocaine. So I'll have, like, these months of no Twitter, no X, and then, like, for a week, I'll just, like, be in the basement shooting up, aka being on X and saying my thoughts and whatever. But I said to myself, you're just singing my song right now, because I said to myself, when I moved here to the Midwest, like, this was kind of my phase out of being plugged into a machine that I knew was annihilating both my spirit and my integrity. Mm-hmm. And I just saw what it was doing for other people and for myself. And I said, oh, you have to, it's the tar baby. So you fight long enough with the tar baby, you are then going to be soaked in tar yourself. You can't fight with it without being in tar yourself.
I think I'm on it, y'all. I think I'm just chilling. I don't know. I think I'm all the things I agree with. And I'm like, I don't know, how do I reach the people? I'm on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram. I feel stuck.
And it's about your temperament, too. Like, even just being friends with you for as long as I have been, Duray, you just have a different temperament around stuff. Like, and I think if you are sunnier, and you're optimistic, and if you have kind of certain beliefs, like, I think you can build the armor to do it.
I think you've also been much more intentional about building a life offline the last few years, because that wasn't always true. And I think you have given yourself perspective and forced a division that wasn't always true for you. I think it's been healthy for you to do that, like, as a friend. Like, I've observed that. And so I think if you can figure out the balance, you can figure out the balance. But I was cussing people out that I know in real life in their Instagram DMs. And I was like, I don't need to be doing this. You know what I mean? Like, I can just wait till I see you to cuss you out. I don't need to be typing this with my thumbs.
If you don't have an I don't give a F button, you know, like, and I hate to be, like, astrology about it, but I'm an Aquarius placement. Okay. So you can be, I do believe it, like, politics can get you so upset, and then you need that button that says, okay, release, where some people don't have it. They just get worse and worse and madder and madder and whatever. And yeah, it gets
ugly. I had my first Christmas season without tamales this year because I was arguing with one of my Mexican friends who voted for Trump. And I was like, look at me, hurting myself.
Now hold on. Okay.
Y'all are wild.
Trump had his tamales. He had his Trump tamales.
Listen, and I did not because I'm arguing in his DMs and I needed a different way of being. So, yes.
Well, that was a great segue to Trump. There, you know, every week feels like a world of stuff going on. I wanted to start with the not State of the Union, but the speech to a joint session of Congress that Trump did, where Trump repeated a lot of things that were not true. My father actually called me this morning and was like, my father's like way more plugged into politics than he's ever been. He's like, Dre, did you hear him talk about the transgender mice? That's not even a thing. He did it. He's like, did you? So my father was like amped. And then Al Green gets censured and 10 Democrats vote for it, which truly, I'm like, y'all, the world's falling apart. How did you support this? But what were your takes on the not State of the Union speech, the censure, the response from the Democrats? Like, what's the what?
I think my reaction has been like, damn, the Democrats really could have tried to do something because he is just like steamrolling them left and right. I think the censure feels like an evolution or an extension of what I've been observing among white Democrats in particular. And that is an attempt at like getting white people back to the party in a way that I just don't think is going to happen. You know, I live in LA, right? Gavin Newsom is my governor. You've probably seen also that he has sort of evolved his stance on like trans athletes in youth sports, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm just like, y'all are trying to out Trump Trump. You know what I mean? And it's like watching that, it feels like an attempt at saving their own necks and their own attempts at like making sure that they stand a chance at being reelected than it is about standing on principle for anything. And the truth of the matter is the political center in this country is already so far right that like the Democrats are, I think, hastening, honestly, our shift in that direction. And it's really sad to see. It's also sad to see and frustrating to see a party that has like really co-opted the language and the tactics of civil rights not stand up for an elder Black elected official, you know, because they would say that they are about that. Mm. And like all of that is just like, I mean, we sort of knew it, but like, damn, did we see it this past week, you know?
I mean, I echo everything that you've been saying. And I've been echoing it for a few weeks now. I think the big thing with the Democrats for me, or I don't even, yeah, the Democrats, but everything, my mind is kind of always in 2028, is how they're just gutting any potential for a victory in 2028. And so here's the thing. When Republicans want to get more power, they go further to their right. So now you see a tent that includes both Nelly and neo-Nazis. Those are two people I didn't think would be able to get along. But Democrats want to court the neo-Nazis. They want to court people who are not that intense in the MAGA to go come back to the Democrats because they don't want any type of interaction with anybody on the further left. And I think that to me is not just a misstep, but there's times I find it disgusting. So when you talk about Gavin Newsom sitting down with, what's his name, Charlie Kirk. I'm glad I don't know his name. My mind is still my own. But when I looked up the misogynistic, the homophobic, transphobic, white supremacist rhetoric he said, and Gavin Newsom is sitting down with him, but you won't sit down with somebody who has further left ideas on what's going on in Palestine or further left ideas about what the society should look like, real conversations about prison abolition, not saying that you're gonna implement it on day one or even if you even believe in it, but you won't even sit down to have those conversations, but you will sit down with a bigot in a tie and say that your son really likes him and this is you trying to flirt with the right. That to me, I find gross. Like that's the feeling I get.
I'm interested, Miles and Sharonda, what do you say to the people who say that the loud left doesn't vote? That there's not necessarily like a political win in courting the loud left because the wild right participates in the process is what people have said, but that there's no like political win in courting the far, far left because they are the people who don't vote in the end.
I think that's true. I think when you look at things that happen on the far left, it does... on the far right, the benefit is the far right wants to establish this establishment, this government. And part of going further and further left is a lot of the rhetoric does talk about revolution, which does talk about a kind of deconstruction or disappearing of the systems that have dominated us. So I do understand that. But I guess my big thing is... you need to be courting these people. What were you doing that you couldn't court the people on the far left? You're saying, like, even so, for instance, I think that you might have sent this in. There was a thing with the trans issues and saying we stuck up for trans issues and, you know, Chaperone said we didn't do anything and stuff like that. I'm like, A, Chaperone is not an activist. B, I was like, well, was I counting or doing letters? But like, A, Chaperone is not an activist. B, you were enticed by rhetoric around trans people that the far right fed you. Mm-hmm. If you want to talk about actual trans issues and want to activate people who are on the left or on the far left, why don't you include things that excite them, which is material changes? So trans issues are still economic and education issues. There's still issues around safety. There's still issues around trans people being the leading in homelessness, the lead in under education, the lead in lead in unemployment. So all those things are still trans issues, but the only time you bring up trans things is when you're talking about this myopic discussion around sports that affects 10 people in the nation. You know, like, that's, to me, that's the reason why you haven't activated people. And even last thing I'll say is, even during Biden's administration, where Biden did this and a lot of Democrats were saying Biden did this, and it's just a messaging thing. On further reflection, I don't know if it was just a messaging thing. I think the things that Biden was doing was like he was running a country in 1998 for the Democratic Party, and that is not what it looks like for 2025. Those things do not excite the people on the left, and it is the Democrats' job to figure that out, not to say, well, they're not coming out, let's put it down. It's to figure out in think tank around what is going to activate these people. But it seems like we don't get that, but there's 10,000 articles and television shows around why Hillbilly Appalachia decided to vote Trump, despite it harming them.
Yeah, I'm not sure that the radical right votes any more than the sort of loud left, to be honest with you, right? Like, those people who think of themselves as, like, sovereign, you know, people, I'm not sure they're rolling up to the polls either. I also think that we underestimate the degree to which most people in this country are politically very practical. To Miles's point, if you give them something that feels like it impacts something they really care about, they will show up. The Democrats have not provided a meaningful alternative on literally anything. And so why should I show up when my life might not feel materially different? And I hate to say it, but people are self-interested in that way. And then I think lastly, the Democrats have not done what they need to do to protect voting rights, to make sure that people who have been disenfranchised because they have a felony on their record or whatever could vote again. And like, we see active efforts in places like Georgia and Florida to dissuade people who might have been able to sort of regain their right to vote to do that. And so like, I think the Democrats have an electorate that they could mobilize if they care to engage them on issues that mattered, and if they care to say that people deserve the right to vote again after they have served their time. But they have not meaningfully done any of that, in my opinion. And so they haven't even engaged the people who are eligible to vote and interested in voting, which they should think about.
I do think, too, you know, some of the, and I'll be interested to see what you have to say, what both of you have to say about this, is that, you know, Biden, for his faults, did do a lot of good stuff that nobody knows about. You know, it becomes this weird thing where, like, you know, even if there are great things that happen, if nobody can recount them, if nobody understands, like, I think about the trans community being able to get passports. Mm-hmm. Like, was the thing that Biden did that, you know, that was the single biggest increase in SNAP ever. Food stamps was Biden. Like, there were these things that were pretty good that, like, materially touched people's lives. Like, there were a lot of those things. You know, the first ever restrictions on use of force, no knocks. Like, there were real things. And I say that only to say that when you ask people who, for whom tracking them is not their work, they literally can't name any of them. And that is a real challenge. Because Sharna's push was like, give people, and yours too, Miles, give people a reason to come to the polls. And I do worry that the Democrats have done a lot of stuff historically, have told really bad stories about it. People don't necessarily understand it. And I don't know, I just want to say that, because I don't think it's true that the Dems haven't done anything. I do think they've done a lot of really good stuff that has changed people's lives, and people can't map it back to the Democrats.
I don't think the Democrats have wanted us to know. I think that they think it's a liability come election time for us to know, right?
Oh, interesting.
And so I think some of this is their own fault, right? Like, instead of saying, like, these are the things that we are doing and these are the things that we stand by, like, who gonna check me, boo, essentially? Like, they don't do that. They try and do it under cover of night, hope you notice, and hope it doesn't make them a target for a more organized, right, and more likely to be vindictive, right? But that's not a winning strategy either.
That's actually, you know, I didn't think about that, but that is true of Kamala and the police, because the Biden-Kamala administration held more police departments accountable than any federal DOJ in the history of this country. Like, they did it. And she would not talk about police. You're like, girl, you guys did it. You did it. It was, you did the thing. And you were right. They did not want people to talk about it. And I actually hadn't thought about it in that way. But that is a, what's it called? Like an unforced error.
Yeah.
I love the idea of them hiding their kind of like left-leaning policies, because they still want to be able to court, you know, Liz Cheney and be able to parade Liz Cheney around and stuff. So that makes a lot, that put a light bulb in my head. I do, and, you know, I just feel like sometimes I hope I'm not just irritating the listener with repeating things over and over, but I do think that there should be a type of separation of things that we implement that are classed, you know, mm-hmm. Like, yes, passports can change. Do you know how many Americans, let's stop talking about trans people, how many Americans don't have a passport? Now think about how many trans, if we talk about the economic things that in the social structures that limit trans people's destinies, do you know how many trans people are not worried about a passport, you know? And I think that is a thing that I would love for Democrats and just people on the left in general to think about, is these solutions that are classed, and specifically to not just class meaning money, but the educated class versus the uneducated class, and who actually feels this, because we need people to feel that their lives are differently, and that we need for people to feel and know that they get $150 more a month from whatever because this person's in office, and that just didn't happen.
I did want to ask you, I don't know if you saw the video of Maxine Waters essentially being like the election was rigged. And, you know, it's when I talked to my father this morning, he also was like, DeRay, something ain't right in the water. He said, oh, I can't explain it, but something don't sound right about this last election. What do you all make of Waters' claim, but this undercurrent that's like Elon really probably did something with this?
I think obviously. Obviously. And I'm like over here, because we talked about this. We've been
tinfoil hat. Put it on.
It's not even tinfoil no more. Because what? Now the tinfoil is too expensive, because there's tariffs on the tinfoil because y'all ain't put the tinfoil on when he first got elected. I think here's the thing about it, and here's how I feel. And I don't know why when people decide to play clean politics versus dirty politics. I felt like something was going on with the election. I think we said that the first week or two of doing the podcast. But here's how I really feel about it, too. Even if there's nothing going on with the election, say there is and make up some shit. And, like, and still push it. That's what they do.
100%.
They don't let any type of win just happen easily. And now you have enough evidence, enough people feeling strange about it, that it can happen. Nobody on our side is going to go storm the Capitol Hill. Go do something about it. But now that we're in March... and you're gonna say it slyly, you lost all the momentum and all the energy you could have had to really, even if you couldn't get him out of here, you get to me, that's a fire that can keep on burning. If people feel like this is somebody who stole their election and stole their vote, that is something that's going to get people out in bigger numbers than what we're seeing right now. And I feel like they totally missed the gate to do that.
Trump was saying the election was about to be stolen before it was over. He was
exactly. Listen, I don't look, I love a good government conspiracy theory, okay? Like, I'm all in. I'm like, yes, absolutely. Somebody was back there, you know. But I will also say that I think one of the reasons that people have immobilized around this is, in my experience, people were surprised to figure out the folks in their circle who voted for Trump. So I do a lot of like multiracial coalition building work. And one of the things that came up on the, you know, the back end of the election and people looking at the exit polls is a lot of the non-Black people in my personal and professional circles were looking at the exit polling data and they were like, nah, not the Latinos I know, nah, not the Asian Americans I know, nah, not the Pacific Islanders I know. And then they started asking their uncles and their cousins and they were like, oh shit, no, it is the people I know, right? And so I think people were like, oh, I've had a whole bunch of secret Trump supporters in my family. So if it's possible that that's true in my circle, it's possible that it's true in so many other circles. So I think people just think that they got, yeah, just caught on their back foot and unaware of how people in their families and friend groups were actually going to vote.
Do you think that the chaos will get so much that this implodes? And like, you know, the park rangers got fired. There's obviously the drama between the FAA and Elon. Rubio is saying that he feels sidelined as the Secretary of State. The Zelensky meeting was a nightmare. You know, he might replace Starlink, the Verizon contract at the FAA with Starlink. Like, they're just... people are being impacted. The farmers are being screwed right now. That, like, the totality of the impact does feel like it's mounting and mounting. The tariffs just got rescinded, but there might be more. Do you think, especially Miles, to your point about class being an issue, it seems like we'll reach a point where people with the least amount of money will be impacted in a way that feels really intense and sudden. And all those government employees who are losing their jobs, you know, most Americans are paycheck or two paychecks away from homelessness. And a part of me just feels like this 7 months of that just feels really, really wild, like wild in a way that feels politically unviable. But who am I to know? I don't know.
So kind of like the depression piece that I bring up often and me seeing the numbers of people who are depressed, the people who are anxious. Even when you think about, as I'm on my on my rehealth journey, whatever the hell you call it, but thinking about the different components that make somebody maybe make unhealthy choices, we are in a society that is a depressed, anxious, and suicidal society. So you can't look at these rates and say these suicide rates amongst men or these suicide rates amongst people and say that this doesn't affect people's energy towards things. And unfortunately, once your count is negative 50, you know how they say wealth, once you're like, have $5 million, $6 million feels pretty much the same. It works the same when you're in negative 50 in your account versus negative 150. So my hunch, it just is true. Yeah. So my hunch is saying that I think the thing that's going to happen is some type of terroristic threat or nuclear thing. I think that kind of thing is going to energize people to be motivated. But the economic stuff, it just is not hitting people. And I think that when you hit people in the arm for so long with the same bat in the same way, the arm just gets numb. And I think you're seeing a numb, depressed people not able to kind of find their nerve. And it's going to take something more radically bad in order to activate the same amounts of people that we've seen activated even 10 years ago, in my opinion.
So you're saying that people have to make a connection between like the lack of safety writ large that Trump has created. Are the planes not enough?
Ooh. So we need, okay.
Oh, this is the class thing again. You're like a lot.
I kind of keep on saying it because I'm like, even the DEI conversation, I'm like, that is a important thing, but that is a privileged person's thing. So I think what most people don't want is for people to think that there are terrorists coming in and blowing things up, or there's a nuclear threat. And I think those are the type of things that people are going to get anxious about and be moved about. Depression, anxiety be damned, debt be damned, the depression that comes from poverty be damned. That is the type of moment that I think is going to activate it, or it's going to be these little fires that get kind of put out, but not really. And we're just going to see that for 4 years.
Yeah, I think people are willing to pay more for eggs if it means that the brown person they don't like is deported to El Salvador. You know?
Hiya!
I think they're like, you know what? That seems like a good deal to me. Sure. You know?
Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Stay tuned. There's more to come. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's been a popping 2 months of 2025, and as we go into March, the thing on my mind has been a question of who's your support system? Who is there to help you think through the world, help you celebrate the wins, think about the challenges, be excited about things, engage in wonder? Who is that for you? What do those people mean to you? How do you engage them? That's really important to me. And thankfully, I've been able to talk through my support system with my therapist, especially in this moment that like glorifies hyper independence and I did it all myself and we can do it alone. It's like the reality is that we all are born from community. Community helps us. Community keeps us whole. Community is where we go when things crash, and community is where we go to celebrate. And therapy can be a great source of support in your life and can help you think more holistically about what support means. And it's time to shift from this doing it all, I did it myself, to an acknowledgement that we often do these things together. Now, therapy has been really important to me because it's helped me have an external person, somebody not in my day-to-day life that I can talk through things with, that I can sort of problem solve, that I can bounce ideas off of. It's been really important to me because I didn't always have this. I was definitely one of the people that was like, I got it. You know, I've been through a lot. I'm proud that I've been able to do this alone. And then I looked up and I was like, none of that was ever true. And therapy is a place that I got to process that. Now, that's why I want to talk to you about BetterHelp. The cool thing about BetterHelp is that it's fully online and it makes therapy affordable and convenient, serving over 5 million people worldwide. And you get to access a diverse network of more than 30,000 credentialed therapists with a wide range of specialties. And you can easily switch therapists anytime at no extra cost. Now build your support system with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/people to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/people. Let's transition to the hazing death, the young black student who was killed. So sad. His picture has been everywhere. He was celebrated at Caleb Wilson was celebrated at Mardi Gras. That was beautiful to see if you saw it online. He was a junior at Southern University and A&M College. I think they've suspended all fraternities and sororities for the time being after his death. And if you do not know this story, he was pledging and apparently there was some sort of hazing incident where he got punched in the chest repeatedly. He died. And there have been conflicting stories about whether they changed his clothes, moved his body before they called 911. There has been one arrest in the case, but it has brought up a lot of conversations about fraternities and sororities and pledging. And I was not in the fraternity. And there's been even a conversation about people not in fraternities and sororities not being able to talk about this, but it's a thing that happened in the past week and we did not talk about it last week. So I wanted to see if anybody had thoughts.
Yeah, when I was an undergrad and all of my friends were thinking about pledging, there was a similar incident at Cal State LA where a young woman who was pledging, AKA drowned. And I think I'm also not, you know, part of a sorority, this might be a class thing actually for me, right? Like I didn't know anybody who wasn't one of my teachers who was part of a Greek organization, right? And then I went to a predominantly white college where, you know, like we didn't have big black Greek presence. So if you were going to pledge, you had to pledge a citywide chapter. And I sort of knew enough to know like that's not really what you wanted to do in undergrad either. And also I was from the hood. And so you weren't finna tell me nothing. You know, you were not like I was not about to stand in front of these like bougie black girls who were going to tell me I couldn't do this. I had to wear that. I had to be up at this time. I was like, no, baby, I fight. So we not going to do that. But I think that what ends up happening in situations like this is that we have not interrogated why these practices have to continue as a way of getting membership into these institutions and what we are asking young people to risk in order to do it, right? So like when, you know, former students come to me and often will say like, hey, I'm thinking about pledging or I think I want to do this. And again, recognizing my limited insight and visibility into that, having dated people who pledged, particularly men who pledged, it's really traumatic. And some of that trauma does not go away. Like I have had conversations with men about their pledging experience that sits with them just like any other child abuse experience. And I wish that Greek organizations were just much more willing to take a hard look in the mirror and say, how do we actually have a conversation about stamping this out? That's not lip service from people who are legacy. That's not lip service from people who are in, you know, that sort of national kind of bureaucratic operations of these organizations, but that were really about like going deep on these campuses. I think that we see enough of this, and honestly, across race, because we see young white people, you know, die too, that like it's really time to figure out like why are we so married to these practices and why do we think that this is the way that we have to bond? I never understood it. And so you're right, people finna be in the comments talking about then I should shut up. But I think we have to be honest about it. I do also think it's really interesting that, I mean, pledging is not cheap either, right? Like that was also a barrier for me in undergrad. And so I really do think it's interesting to think about people being second, third, fourth generation members of these organizations and having to endure this kind of treatment in the name of fraternity.
This was a tough one. So a couple things. I think that I reflect on my 20s a lot because of the odd way that I lived my 20s. So because I didn't go to college, I now see at 34 me not going to college as an ability to kind of maintain this almost cold, observative, oppositional way of looking at things. And it feels very clear to me that the things that are happening are cult-like. You know, that's been my the most interesting lens.
Is that woman paying you? The knitting culture?
No.
Y'all haven't gotten her on yet, right? Y'all still waiting on that?
Listen, I should be paying her because it just clicks things for me, you know, and I've always been really interested specifically in the 70s, in what this, how the 60s birthed, what happened in the 70s and, you know, the Manson murders happening in 69 and just when you turn everything into the marketplace, people look for church and home. And now that we're in this second wave of turning everything into the market, these are my own ideas at this point. But once you turn, once we have this second wave of the marketplace, where is everything's a digital marketplace, there is such a need for home and familiarity and safety. And also with Black people, that's always lived in Black people is the desire to assimilate and to gain power. And these organizations have been gateways to get such assimilation and power. And that has all, and when you look at the practices that are happening inside of Greek organizations and you look at the practices that happen in the military, they're the same. And I promise you, the military, now this is what I got from her, the military is its own cult as well, to be able to go through it. And when you look at the practices, and I think Black people, and I've been thinking about this a lot, and I think that's is the reason why I've been so fascinated with it, is because she's a frilly white lady. But as a Black person, I see so many things that have been called Black excellence, Black exceptionalism, Black joy, that are actually these cult-like moments where Black people have to be smiling, dandy sambos instead of how we really feel, because we want to accumulate assimilation or power. And I think this is an example of the toxicity of that. And I think that's how come it's been a lightning rod, because I do think there's something in this culture that's happening right now that people want to be done with these organizations, in quotes, institutions, in quotes, that are really these legalized cults.
That makes sense to me. How do you reconcile that, though, with the, you know, the history of, my sister is in a sorority, and the history of needing solidarity, camaraderie, the service orientation, especially in a world of white supremacy, making sure that there are organized groups of Black people who have some sort of relationship and kinship to them feels powerful. And I think we all know people who probably didn't have awful pledging experiences, right? Who had more say. I know some people had some not great ones. I know some people had some okay ones. And who, for whom the relationship has actually been powerful in life and not necessarily cultish, but in a sort of membership-based organization like others would be. How do you make space for that? I mean, not in defense of hazing, because yeah, the boy should be alive today, and that is sort of wild.
But I think that's why I'm like, what's the strategy that these Greek organizations are putting in place to actually talk to young people about not hazing, right? It's like they know it's still happening. And I don't know what kind of guidance they're giving or what kind of consequences, right? Like, it feels like there's only ever a consequence when the outcome is something as tragic as this, right? But it's like, you have to know that it's still going on. I do think that community is important. I do understand the legacy of these organizations. I understand what they give people, particularly even at PWIs, right? I think one of the reasons why people wanted to pledge the citywide chapter when I was an undergrad was because they were like, look, we are 0.2% of, you know, students on this campus. I'm looking for people who look like me. I'm looking for community. I just think that the consequences are too great for these organizations to not be more serious about like confronting this and dealing with it. I mean, this young person is facing what, manslaughter charges in Louisiana, which, as we know, is the incarceration capital of the world, you know? And like the consequences to him, and I know that we're thinking about Caleb right now, right? But the consequences to him and the other young men who were involved and what they thought of as a ritual, right, are also too great for us to not be more serious about dealing with it.
I do think that what we're seeing is a weather forecast. So I think it just has less to do with what we want to happen or where can we find kinship. I just think these institutions are probably dying. A, we know that Black men, unlike Black women, are not getting into college. We know just men in general in America that in college and that kind of mobility is just doesn't seem to be happening for men. So I wonder what that would do to Greek institutions in general. But it just reminds me of the Black church, that it feels like an autopsy on a dying thing than it feels about trying to keep this thing alive. I think that, no, it's done. It's going to wither out. It will be interesting to see where these organizations are even 50 years in the future and how strong they are. And I wouldn't be surprised if they're mirroring other Black-led organizations like the Black Church, the Democratic Party, these other places where Black people were kind of the glue inside of them, the soul inside of them. It seems like those institutions are dying. I think that this might be another thing and another one of those things. And this incident is the I hate saying it like this, but there's the tumor showing that there's something that's already dying and on its way out, in my opinion.
I have seen a lot more people pledge alumni or grad chapters, right? Or pledge grad chapter. Mm-hmm. And I think partially probably to avoid some of this, right?
So there's no hazing when you do it older?
That's my understanding. And also, mm-hmm. like, if you were poor in undergrad, you ain't had no money to pledge, you know? So
absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
Let's go to our news. I'll start with the news. So my news is about retinol. Before I became into the gym, I was into skincare. That was my trade-off. I was like, at least my skin is going to look great. I might be a little scrawny, but that's okay. I got retinol, retin up, retin down. I got serums and moisturizers. And then I was like, oh, I think I can do the gym. But I did not know that before Retin-A was approved by the FDA in 1971, that it was tested on hundreds of incarcerated people in Philadelphia as a part of a program that was run by a dermatologist named Albert Kligman. And Team Vogue did a really solid write-up on this, and they remind us that between 1951 and 1974, Dr. Kligman and his team experimented on a ton of vulnerable people, most of whom were held at the Holmesburg Prison in Philadelphia. And they needed people to test on. So his goal was pharmaceuticals, Cosmetics, which is where retinol comes from, and chemical warfare agents. And the way that they did this is patch tests. So they would put untested creams and chemicals on people's bodies, so backs, faces, and arms, as well as biopsies of their organs. They would give them injections and a host of other things. And some people were technically paid. So one former participant, because there's a book about this called Acres of Skin, Human Experiments at Holmesburg Prison. One guy is quoted as saying, I got a needle in my spine for $7. Mind you, he's incarcerated. So as you can imagine, people left with all types of scars, injuries, and there's now a book that has come out about it. And women were also involved in the, quote, experiments. Of course, Dr. Klingman and the way that his team talks about it is that they were volunteers, and they were testing out tampons and other things on women as well. And as you can imagine, the rationale was that it was cheap. They were a consistent population. They were, you know, prison jobs were scarce, and they didn't have to pay them a living wage. So I brought it up because I was fascinated by this. We say everything comes back to race. It is true, but this is the intersection of race and criminal justice. And we obviously know about Tuskegee, the Tuskegee experiment, but I literally, I just didn't know about this. And there's more to the story. People sued and it was shut down in 1974 and blah, blah, blah. But the discovery of Retin-A was a huge professional success and financial success for Dr. Klingman. And I just wanted to bring it here. And, you know, he died in 2010 at 93. And he is quoted as saying, I'm on the medical ethics committee at Penn, and I still don't see there having been anything wrong with what we were doing. And he's quoted in 2006 as saying that shutting down the experiments at the prison was, quote, a big mistake. So I'll stop there, but I wanted to bring it because this is something that truly surprised me. I was fascinated by it, and I wanted to see what you all thought.
I think my reaction was, holy shit, that was yesterday, right? And I think that when we think about the history of medical experimentation on people, particularly like Black people, we think of it as something that happened so long ago. And thinking about the fact that, like, you know, my mom was in high school, you know? And I think I'm always just struck by how recent our history is, which I, you know, is one thing. I also think about, you know, as we were just talking earlier about legacy and what we pass down from generation to generation, right? This is a person who never expressed remorse, never came to have an intersectional lens on how what he did targeted a very specific population, right? And how if he had tried to target different populations or communities, it just would not have been okay. And you think about all of the people he mentored, right? All of the studies he was able to green light. And you think about what was underpinning people's assumptions about who made for the best test subjects, right? Or the most viable test subjects. And it's just, yeah, holy shit, that was yesterday. And this man's legacy is long, and people he has trained and mentored are still conducting research and still greenlighting research. And so it's what's the shift about how we think about, ethics in science. And, you know, we were talking before we officially started recording today. I have a similar set of concerns around AI and around how we are rolling out AI and how we are, you know, talking to young people, particularly low-income young people of color, about the promise and potential of AI. And no one is ever talking about the ethics of science when they're on the cutting edge of something that feels like it could be game-changing. And I'm sure that they felt like they were on the cutting edge of something that felt like it could be game-changing. And so in order to get that breakthrough, people are always willing to set aside ethics and morals, and it's terrifying.
Miles, before you go, I just want to, so it's this, the Vogue article is a recap in some ways of the book, Acres of Skin, Human Experiments at Holmesburg Prison. The title Acres of Skin comes from a quote that Kligman gave when he entered the prison. And the quote is, "All I saw before me were acres of skin. It was like a farmer seeing a fertile field for the first time."
40 acres of skin, might it be? So, excuse me, I feel like y'all might know more than, but the former Teen Vogue editor-in-chief, Elaine Welteroff? Yeah. So, of course, I think the article and what it and what the book details is disgusting. I think what the article shines a light on is gross and disgusting, but well connects with the history of humiliation and the use of Black person as science subjects. So I do think about Henrietta Lacks. I do even think about this story kind of. To me, intersects between Henrietta Lacks and Venus Hottentot because of the beauty in the science and in the all of it in the using of Black bodies for white beauty. You know, even if you're a Black person using these products, it's oftentimes to accomplish a type of beauty that whiteness has told you is the new beauty, and that beauty is shifting and not static because it needs to keep on growing because you can never attain it. I think my thing with it is with reading this article is I'm a little bit over. I know there's a new editor in chief, but I think Elaine Welteroff was the editor in chief who kind of brought this type of investigative, critical, social lens to Teen Vogue. And I think that was interesting. 2016, 2017, it just reads totally empty and like neoliberal bullshit when you're Teen Vogue talking about the history of retinol. So what are you doing, Teen Vogue? What, like, so you're showing it to us, you're gonna go viral, you're gonna be able to paint yourself with these critiques that are seen as leftist and critical, but you're not doing anything for it. In fact, I'm sure that the very magazine that you got has beauty companies that are going to be using retinol. So it's a weird thing because I feel like in 2025, this is one of the reasons why as a collective left and a cultural left, we're not further because we keep on letting companies be able to annihilate and destroy us and also sell us our own critiques and be able to benefit from both sides, be able to play from both sides without actually having any moral, without having any moral gumption, which really looks like, oh, putting your dollars and your profit where these articles are. So I want more from publications and media publications who want to participate in feminist, anti-imperialist, critical capitalist critiques without doing any of meaningful work with it. But this was a fascinating article, though, nonetheless.
Don't go anywhere. More Pod Save the People's coming. Pod Save the People is brought to you by Mosh. About a year and a half ago, I decided to take the fitness journey seriously. I'd sort of started and stopped and, you know, it didn't work out. But like a year and a half, 2 years ago, I was like, okay, I can do it. And I'm just going to do small things every day that get me closer to being fit. And a part of that has been being more thoughtful about what I eat. That before this, I didn't know anything about protein or pre-workout. Like, I knew nothing. I just sort of was like, I think this is healthy, and I just did that. And then once I got on the fitness journey, I was like, okay, let me like be more thoughtful. And one of the surprising things is about the importance of protein. I just didn't know about eating enough protein a day when you work out. I had no clue. And that's what brings me to Mosh. It really is the best protein snack that they have out there. And it just is solid. Like, I had no clue about protein or protein snacks. And now I do. And that's why I love Mosh. And you might have already heard about it because it was founded by Maria Shriver and her son, Patrick Schwarzenegger. And they were on Shark Tank. And they just wanted to create a conversation about brain health through food, education, and research. Now, Maria's father suffered from Alzheimer's, and since then, she and Patrick have dedicated themselves to trying to figure out ways to help other families dealing with the disease. Now, Mosh joined forces with the world's top scientists and functional nutritionists to go beyond your average protein bar. And they have 8 delicious flavors, including a plant-based one in peanut butter and chocolate. And each of the Mosh bars is made with ingredients that support brain health, like ashwagandha, lion's mane, collagen, and omega-3s. Now, I'll tell you, before I started my fitness journey, I had no clue what any of these are, and certainly didn't know that there was a bar like Mosh out there that had any great ingredients or protein. And now Mosh Bars come with a new look and a new formulation, featuring a game-changing, brain-boosting ingredient you won't find in any other bar. Mosh is now the first and only food brand boosted with Cognizant, a premium nootropic that supplies the brain with a patented form of acetylcholine. And here's the best part to make you feel good. Mosh donates a portion of all proceeds from your order to fund gender-based brain health research through the Women's Alzheimer's Movement. Why gender-based? Well, because 2/3 of all Alzheimer's patients are women, and Mosh is working closely to close the gap between women and men's health research. Now, like I said, I didn't know anything about protein bars, and in the research that I've done, I realized that Mosh is at the top of the pack. If you want to find ways to give back to others and fuel your body and brain, Mosh bars are the perfect choice for you. Head to moshlife.com/PTSP to save 20% off plus free shipping on the bestsellers trial pack. That's 20% off plus free shipping on the bestsellers trial pack at moshlife.com/PTSP. Thank you, Mosh, for sponsoring the episode.
My news this week is about a new study on the causes of bacterial vaginosis in people with vaginas. And the study is about how to best treat bacterial vaginosis, or BV. And I think the reason that this is sort of my story this week, or why I wanted to focus on it, is that 1 in 3 women will be diagnosed with BV, which is like a super high, that's a high number, right? And what ends up happening is most often doctors will tell you this is not an STI, this is an imbalance of bacteria in the vagina. And so, like, you take this, you know, set of antibiotics for 7 days and then you will be fine. What this study has revealed, though, is that 60% of people who go through that course of treatment experience a recurrence of BV within a year, which is also very high. And they are learning that it actually might be an STI, and that the important thing is to, if those women are having sex with people who are men or who have penises, right, that they should also treat their partners. Why does this matter? Because everybody's been told, like, it's a super, you know, common thing. You just take these antibiotics and you'll be fine. But what they also know is that having recurring instances of BV increases your chances of contracting other STIs, including chlamydia, HIV, or pelvic inflammatory disease. That if you are pregnant and have BV, you have an increased risk of having a preterm birth. And so it's really important that we figure this out and we figure out how to treat people. And I really wanted to bring it to the pod first for conversation, but also just so that listeners know that if this is something you go to the doctor and your doctor is like, oh, you have BV, here is your 7 days of antibiotics, that you sort of let them know that there's new and evolving evidence that it's an STI, that you want to make sure that your partner gets tested and treated too, so that you are at less risk of contracting these other STIs. It also just is a reminder that there's so much that we don't know about our bodies, particularly the bodies of people who have vaginas, because we just don't study them in the way that we should. We've got to advocate for ourselves. And so, yeah, I wanted to bring it to the pod for discussion.
So I, you know, as a person without a vagina and somebody who is a gold star gay, this is new to me. So
I don't know what a gold star gay is, Duray. Can you please explain?
I do, because they keep telling me I'm not invited to the party.
For the listeners
can Google. But the only thing I'll add is that Black women have a twice as high an occurrence of bacterial vaginosis, mm-hmm. with more than 50% of Black women at childbearing age at some point experiencing it. So thank you for bringing it to the pie. And this was a complete learning for me.
So, and it's funny that we had this conversation earlier. I can't remember if it was on or off the podcast, but we were having a conversation around trans issues. Yeah, that was earlier in our in the Trump storm of some conversation. But we were talking about trans issues. So to me, this is such a great way to enter cis and trans coalition building. So instead of it being around passports and being around these very class individualistic things, how about we even... I hear you when you're like kind of inclusive language, but really bring in trans men in to talk about this too. So usually if something is affecting black women, black cis women, it's going to probably be affecting black trans men too, because they're often are going to still have those same like bodily functions. And that is such a meaningful way to connect and to build coalition. And that's what this made me think of too. And I've always thought about the same thing when it came to non-binary people and trans women and cis men and prostate cancer and all these different things that we can really join hands on and talk about that isn't divisive, because now we're actually coming together on what we have in common in our bodies instead of making a spectacle about what makes our bodies different. And the matter of fact is, in which your article details, is that in the medical industry, a black body is not safe, and everybody can get behind that no matter what your Bible told you.
Yeah. Last thing I'll say is, you know, one of my good friends is a clinician and works with a lot of cis hetero couples. And if you are a cis hetero man, you also need to get checked. Please stop trying to get checked by proxy, right? What I hear all the time is like, well, if she's good, I'm good. If she don't got it, I don't got it. No, 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 no. Everybody get tested, do all the things for yourself. Have fun, obviously, but stay safe.
And y'all cheat. I don't know when we're gonna get into that, but and y'all cheat, so don't. There's so many times I've heard that, and I'm like, you're a cheater, so you're an infidel. So, so I'm on this lifelong quest of trying to find black people in spaces that I'm not used to finding black people in, and my latest find that I've been digging deep for is Abel Selu Chua. I've been practicing that name. It may not be right, but you know, my heart pronounced his name right, and that's all that matters. So first things first, I'm on my classical music app, and I start hearing this these cello string sounds, and I'm like, this is beautiful. Okay, I'm transcended. Then I start hearing this gnarly growl, these chants coming along with these strings. And then all of a sudden, I go and look at the album cover and I see this black man. And I'm like, what is going on? So the album that I'm talking about is Hymns of Bantu. And they are, first of all, the album's spectacular. When you talk about marrying worlds, it does that. And there are certain songs on the album, certain movements of the album, because that's what classical people call their music. It's not songs, it's movements. There are certain movements of the album that literally articulate sonically the sounds of colonization. So he sounds like he's crying as these lush strings are coming in, which perfectly describes I would think the French going into Haiti, or everybody going into West Africa. It just has that kind of that tension inside of it. That's really interesting. He is a South African cellist. He just dropped the album on February 21st. So it's new. So I'm trying to think more about people who are living doing this work too. So people who are here to get their flowers and get their recognition can get them. Sometimes I could be a little bit of a nostalgia file. I wanted to bring his work to you all. He's from South Africa. The music's really, really interesting. And again, the last thing that I'll say when it comes to his work is, and this goes for most of the people who I brought up this year so far, is what I didn't know is listening to black people do different things also helps you access different imaginations. Because when you listen to music, and let's say if I'm listening to John Coltrane's Giant Steps, I know that I'm living inside of that imagination that at birth, because I look at my partner, I look at my life, and I know that I'm living inside of a Love Supreme. I know I'm living inside of Pharoah Sanders, everything, every album Pharoah Sanders did. But being in this music, it made my imagination have to make a movie that it never had to make before. It had to almost reimagine a history where we're victorious, because at the end of the day, it is his cello and his voice that are here at the end of this album, which means that this Black person is embodying victory, which makes me have to think about the future differently and think about what is the politics and the ideas and what kind of imagination I have to do to make that right. And it also makes me think of history differently, you know? I think, although it's been done evil, I think white people are onto something when it comes to editing and reframing and reimagining histories in order to serve the culture and the victory that you want to see. And I think this piece of music does that amazingly. I hope you all listen to it. Take a break from Lady Gaga's Mayhem, that is great as well. And listen
to...
You
figured it out.
And listen to this album, y'all. It's so good. It's so good.
Yeah, I listened to the interview and read the article. I think what I was also struck by is... how hard he fought to realize this dream, to bring this music and this piece into the world, right? Given where he started, what he did not have access to early in life, and how much, to your point of like being pushed into a place and space of being able to dream of something new. I cannot imagine, given all that he saw around him, how he was able to see what he has created now. He didn't even have an instrument to play on, right? When he started. And so I'm always thinking about, particularly in moments when I feel like I'm lacking imagination, or like I'm lacking conviction or a sense of possibility, to be reminded that I am part of a people who have made literally everything from nothing, right? And so I think, you know, all that we talked about at the top of the pod and everything that felt heavy and hard this past week, being able to share space, you know, via listening to this interview with someone who was such a dreamer, who has such a sense of possibility, was really welcome for me.
Listen to the music too, because he yells, and I live by myself most of the time because my boyfriend be at school, so I was yelling with him, and I felt good. I felt my ancestors. I felt my help. So it is, you know.
I don't have much to add. This was new to me. It reminds me of like the uncovering that is happening now in the historical texts that are like all these amazing white musicians and authors and da-da, were really people just repackaging stuff that Black enslaved people did or had written or had cooked or had da-da-da-da-da. And I there's something about this that just reminded me of that like when we look at the legacy of the best classical artists and the best da-da-da, they are all white. And you're like, I don't know. I think this guy who had no training might have been the person Bach was learning from. So I'm always interested. Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Stay tuned. There's more to come. Pod Save the People is brought to you by ZBiotics Sugar to Fiber. I didn't really start thinking about fiber till I was an adult. Didn't know it was something I had to be thoughtful about. I guess I just ate a lot of sandwiches as a kid, and that sort of was the fiber that I was eating. I don't know. But as I've gotten older, I have been more thoughtful about my fiber intake, and it sometimes gets annoying to have to think about like supplements or, you know, taking pills to do it. And that's why I got into the ZBiotics Sugar to Fiber Probiotic Mix, because it literally helps just take the extra sugar, turn into fiber, boom. Now, the dieting part of the health journey or the fitness is really sometimes a lot. I feel like I'm either eating too much, not eating enough. And that really is how I got to the sugar to fiber probiotic mix, because PhD microbiologists over at ZBiotics, they understand that extra sugar is all but impossible to avoid these days, and 95% of Americans don't get enough fiber. So they genetically engineered a probiotic to convert some extra sugar from our everyday diet into a prebiotic fiber called levin. This leads to a more balanced microbiome, which is the key to a healthy gut. One stick pack of sugar to fiber, and you get a daily dose of fiber from the food you already eat. It is amazing. Now, the way I put this into my routine is that with lunch, I make sure I drink one of the sugar to fiber mixes, and it's super easy, tastes good. And because I've already eaten breakfast and eaten some snacks, there's some sugar there to convert. And I really like knowing that this is where my fiber is coming from the extra sugar. And I like to know that, like, I'm getting a daily dose, I got what I need, and I don't have to go do backflips with my diet. So every day I have one with lunch, big fan, and it supports my gut health. In 2025, I am prioritizing my microbiome. Sugar to fiber is my daily insurance that makes sure I'm getting a fiber. Go to zbiotics.com/PSTP and use PSTP at checkout for 15% off any first-time orders of ZBiotics probiotics. ZBiotics has a 100% money-back guarantee, so if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money, no questions asked. Thank you, ZBiotics, for sponsoring this episode. This week, we welcome New York Times bestselling author Nick Stone on the pod, and we talk about her book, Dear Manny, the third and final installment of her young adult fiction book series that began with Dear Martin. Now, Nick's books have been banned and challenged in schools and libraries across the country. What she does in this third book is just really brilliant. You gotta read it. Nick is a star. Can't wait for you to hear her voice. Here we go. Nick Stone, it is great to have you back on the podcast.
A pleasure. I'm excited to be here. Excited to be back.
So I want to tell you, I only told one person I was talking to you today, one of my best friends from college, Burgess. She teaches middle school English, and she was super pumped. She sent me a text after we talked, being like, wait, let me just read it. She said, our school is obsessed with Nick Stone, by the way. You are a legend in these streets. So I just wanted to give you your kudos on the front end. And it was great to read this book. I was really pumped about it. So it's good to hear your voice again.
Look, I'm glad to hear that you were pumped about it. It is a grand experiment. So I'm excited to talk about it.
You also are just such an honest writer. Like as the book closes, when you talk about what it was like to write from this perspective, I was like, you know, they need more Nick Stones in the world. But let us start with, some people might not be familiar with the series, but let's start with like how you became a writer. Did you wake up one day and you were like, this book is on my soul? Did you always know you were going to be a writer? Like, what was that like?
Not at all. I started writing at 27. I will be 40 in July. Sporty 40 on them.
Woo, woo. Me too. Me that. Too. Wait, what are you? July what? What is your July?
I'm the 10th. I think you're what?
Okay,
the
yeah, I'm the 9th. Yeah, 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 yeah.
Yeah. My twin. I love you know what it. Saying? But it took me a while to even realize writing was something I could do. Because, you know, we grew up at the same time. We didn't have no books with us in them. I was introduced to fiction written by Black people when I went to my HBCU, right? So it took a while for me to even recognize writing as something that I could pursue. But once I did, it's really, I started having kids and like recognizing that my kids were going to have a similar experience to me if I didn't do something about it, right? So I decided to start writing largely because I wanted them to see themselves reflected in books in a way that I didn't.
I love it. And before we talk about this book, one of the things I wanted to ask you, because I'm so curious, I wrote nonfiction, but you get to write like other worlds and you get to make people and characters. And even Dear Manny is so interesting, just the like the style of writing where it goes into like script. And I'm like, this is cool. But what I wanted to ask you is, what is it like to take your books on the road? You know, because people sort of get to live in this world with you in a way that's very different. My book, you know, is like, it was sort of my perspective. It's my story. It's nonfiction. But I'm always curious, like, what is it like with fiction to have kids talk to you all over the country about your books?
Oh, man. Like, there's literally nothing like that. So I started my tour technically last Friday, and I've encountered at least 1,000 kids so far, like just in the past week.
I love it.
Honestly, probably more, because it was 550 just yesterday. And they just be so gassed. Like, they're so geeked and excited, and they want to talk to you, and they want to tell you how they feel about this character, and like, why did you do that on page 133? And it's just, it's beyond anything I could have possibly imagined, because like, we just did not have this. Like, the people that we were told we had to read when we were kids are all dead and have right. been dead for a really long time.
And if they weren't dead, you definitely weren't going to see them at your school.
100%. Absolutely not. Right. Like, Mark Twain been gone and Harper Lee was not pulling up nowhere. So it's such a cool experience. And like, I wouldn't have it any other way. Like, it's amazing to write for an audience that I actually have access to.
I love it. Well, start us out with the series, and then we'll talk more specifically about Dear Manny. For people who have not read any of the books, can you help us understand the world a little better so we can get to Dear Manny?
Yeah, totally. So it starts with Dear Martin. Dear Martin published in October of 2017, and that one follows a 17-year-old African-American boy who has this really gross experience with racial profiling and as a result decides to start a journal of letters to the late Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. to see how Dr. King's teachings hold up in the 21st century. Obviously, Dr. King cannot respond to these letters, so I essentially set up a world where you have young people writing letters to process their own thoughts, process their feelings, process their experiences. So Dear Martin came out in 2017. 2020 was Dear Justice. So the main character from Dear Martin.
Justice with a Y.
Justice with a Y, correct. And in Dear Justice, we have a character that we meet in Dear Martin writing to the main character of Dear Martin. These are very different books. The first one, Justice, the main character of Dear Martin is super high achieving. He's like Ivy League bound, captain of the debate team, never does anything wrong, and still finds himself on the receiving end of racist abuse, right? And then in the second book, we encounter a kid who's quite literally the opposite. Like, they grew up together, but just went in totally different directions. Laquan is locked up, awaiting trial on murder charges, and honestly just doesn't have a very good sense of who he is as a person. So his journey is all about coming to grips with the power that's inside of him. Now, this third one, like, I didn't plan to do a second one, and I certainly didn't plan to do a third one. But, I mean, Dear Martin and Dear Justice get banned a lot. So this is my
wait, before Trojan we go on, how did, do you get like a, do you get like an email? Like, how do you know?
100%. People email me, right? So it'll be a teacher or a parent in a district who's upset because we heard your book was getting pulled. Or I've had a bookseller reach out to me and be like, we're pissed off. Can you come hang out with us? You know, so it's always somebody in the community who is upset about the ban, letting me know that it has happened.
Do you remember your first one?
100%. It came literally right before the idea for Dear Manny did. So this was 2019. The book Jackpot had just released into the world. I was on tour. I think I was in Seattle. And I get this email from a teacher in Columbia County, Georgia, which is like a couple hours south of me. I'm in Atlanta. And she was just livid because the superintendent had pulled Dear Martin from all the schools. She pulled that book and she pulled a couple of others. But every time this woman was asked, like, why she had pulled Dear Martin, she gave a different answer. She eventually retired. Like, at the end of that school year, she retired. I think, you know, she kind of got run out. But now she's on the library board and is trying to get it moved from the YA section to the adult section now. So she hasn't given up. But it was that first banning incident that kind of led me to where we are now.
Okay. Well, yeah. What was interesting to me about Dear Manny, from the very beginning, so I'm not, no spoiler, it's a white main character, uh-huh, which is not true of Dear Justice and Dear Martin. Mm-mm. And it's funny, even the names, I was like, these are the white people I went to college with. I was like, here mm-hmm. we go. Tell us why this perspective and why this arc and what you're hoping to do in Dear Manny.
You know, as I said, Dear Manny is an experiment. With Dear Martin and Dear Justice getting banned so frequently, I decided to, okay, so let's give this a try, right? I'm going to send the exact same message, exact same fact points, exact same pieces of history. We're just going to tell it through a different perspective. We're going to tell it through the perspective of a kid who looks like the people who are doing the book banning, right? The idea for this landed shortly after that first ban, because I was just like, you're giving these answers saying like the content is divisive was one reason she said that she was taking it out of the schools. And I was like, okay. Then another time she said that it was sexually explicit, and there's no sex in any of these books, y'all.
Yeah. I'm like, what? Like, what was sexually nowhere, explicit?
There's nothing sexually explicit in any of these books.
Literally.
At all.
And I will give you credit. The way that consent is done in Dear Manny.
Oh, we don't play.
Beautiful. Super thoughtful. I'm like, yeah. This is modeling This was very well done.
100%. And that's, I hang out with kids. They tell me what they be doing, right? And then the third time she was asked, she said something about the content being inappropriate for high schoolers. So I'm like, so it's inappropriate for people to talk about things that they are actively experiencing in their daily lives. And it just got under my skin. So as time progressed and more books get banned, it's like, oh, y'all are banning all the books about Black kids and kids of color and gay kids, right? Like, it's like the three kind, there's the books about Black kids, those get tossed out. The books about kids on the LGBTQIAP plus spectrum, those get tossed out. And the books about kids of color in general tend to get tossed out. And so I'm like, this feels like a racial thing. So let's just try. Let's just see if we put a kid who looks like Ron DeSantis on the cover, how he'll respond to that.
You know, what's so hard talking to you is that I don't want to give it away. But I really did appreciate, as a kid who grew up in student government.
Yeah.
I was like, you know, I really appreciate this sort of understory here. I was like,
me too, friend.
I'm with this. But, you know, for those of you who have not written a book, you have to write a book long before the world ever sees it.
100%.
Now, Nick, what was so interesting about that, just reality, is that there are some themes in this book that are shockingly timely. And shockingly. Almost, Nick is a future teller or whatever, because I was like, wow, this is very on the nose. And I know you had to turn this book in a long time ago. Are there any of those themes you want to talk about? I'll let you manage spoiler land and not me, but... I don't want to, you know, you talk about DEI, DEI is present in the book. Affirmative action is present in the book. Legacy of missions is present in the book, alongside all these sort of what it's like to be a kid and just growing up and people's parents and money and no money and the sort of framework of assault, domestic assault. Mm-hmm. Which of those, I'm trying really hard not to spoil anything. So I will just say, can you talk about any of them?
Yeah, I can't. So what's interesting about this book is you're so right. I turned this book in, like the first draft of this book, I turned in like a year and a half ago. So, and it's not like the themes in the book weren't things we are talking about. It's just now people have gotten loud about it, right? Like it's like back when Dear Martin was first banned in 2019. This is prior to 2020 and George Floyd and the explosion of books about race and racism, right? So it's like, I'm just telling the truth that I see around me. And it just so happens that other people are noticing that same truth around the time that the book comes out. I'm thrilled that that keeps happening. Like, I'm not mad at it at all. But it absolutely touches on book banning. It touches on DEI. It touches on assault culture. It touches on government. There's a lot of constitutional content in this book. Part of the reason for that is because, like, we don't teach kids civics. So, like, there are so many kids who are going to school and have no idea what it actually means to even be American. Like, what does it mean to be an American citizen? What are you supposed to be guaranteed as a person who is an American citizen? Kids have no idea about this stuff. So I wanted to kind of infuse it, since it is a book about student government. The main character is running for junior class council president at college. I was senior class president. I know you were, I think you were too, right?
I was school president and class president.
There you go. Right. So like student government is a thing.
It's a thing.
And so it was fun kind of mining my own experiences from student government and also using the lens of student government to talk about our wider government. Right. Especially right now. So like the stuff that is most interesting to me that I wound up including in the book and that I'm interested to see how people respond to is the stuff around the Constitution. So in Dear Martin, there was a class called, I think, Contemporary Issues or something. I can't remember. I wrote that book a long time ago. but there was a class featured in that book where a lot of the discussions happened. And so I put a class, honestly, beat by beat. This book is pretty close to Dear Martin on purpose. So the class in this book is constitutional law. And so they're discussing book banning through the lens of the Constitution. They're discussing like, okay, does it fall more under First Amendment violation or 14th Amendment violation? Is it about freedom of speech or is it about equal protection under the law? Like helping get, like, I wanted to like give some fodder for classroom discussions around what it actually means to be an American, because right now I feel like that is being challenged in so many directions. And y'all not gonna tell me I'm not American. I probably know more about being American than you do, because I actually read the Constitution. Have you read it, sir? You know what I'm saying?
Y'all, this is the one and only Nick Stone. There are two questions I wanted to ask that we didn't talk about the last time we talked on the podcast. The first is, you know, your kids have grown up with you as a writer. Mm-hmm. How has motherhood, parenthood informed the way you've grown as a writer?
That's a really good question. I mean, honestly, I started writing because of my kids. I keep writing because, like, I got bills to pay because of my kids. But what I will say is just watching them grow as readers has helped to inform the things that I want to write about. And that's been really exciting. Like my younger son has started writing as well. He has given himself a pen name. Yeah, he's got a pen name based on his middle name, just like I do. And it is, he's been on tour with me. This first week of tour, he was with me the whole week.
How's he like tour?
Oh, he hated it. Like, by the time we got to last night, he was done. Like, ready to be done. Because we talking like 12-hour days. I'm in three schools, and then I got an evening event, you know. So he's running with me. And yeah, this morning when we got home, we landed at like 7:30 this morning. And he was like, Mommy, I'm not going with you today.
I love it. He said, I've done it.
He said, I'm done. I need you to call Granddad. So he's at his Granddad's house, chilling with Granddad today, because he was not with it anymore. But the things that they're interested in inform the things that I decide to write about, and also the things that they're like facing and dealing with, right? So it's wild to see my older son is 12 right now, and he's in middle school. He's in seventh grade, and just watching his seventh grade experience, because I vividly remember mine. Part of being a children's book author is that like you have to actually think about and remember your own childhood, even the parts that were uncomfortable. So watching him go through the seventh grade blues essentially has been really fascinating. And they're very big on letting me know what they like and don't like. And I find that like the older they get, the more comfortable I am being a little like grittier with regard to the stuff I put in children's books, because you know, they deal with some really hard stuff.
And it is the biggest thing in their world.
Yeah.
At the time.
Absolutely. Because it was the biggest thing in mine.
Right. And I taught middle school. I taught sixth grade. And I, seventh grade was awful because it was puberty, but sixth grade was still magical. And they're
still so sweet.
They're so sweet. They were great. I also wanted to ask you now three books in this series, mm-hmm. and A World That We Know Well. What are you proud of? Like, you've had such a cool career as an author. I'd love to know, like, what you're proud of.
I will say writing this book in particular was incredibly empowering for me as a queer Black woman. Like, to write this book about this straight white boy that I know people are going to buy because they bought the other two books in the series, and that I know people are going to read, it felt empowering to me to be like, no, I can tell this story too. Like, this is, I've been drowning in this story for years now, so I can tell it with no qualms, no issues, watch me work. Type. Like, that's the energy that I've been coming with it.
I love it.
And I'm actually really excited about people being upset, because I know I obviously I don't have a problem making people mad, right? With Dear Martin and Dear Justice, I know it was some people who were mad, but it's from that place of discomfort that real change starts to happen. And so I really do want to challenge people to actually take the time to engage with the opposite side, the opposite perspective, even if just so that you understand it in contrast to your own. I really do want people to take the time and try to like empathize across the line and recognize that, yes, these people who you totally disagree with are still people. Like, I really do want us to get back into a space where we're able to engage in just like healthy debate and dialogue. And nobody's mind needs to be changed, you know, like the way democracy functions. Majority rules. That's it, right? So But that doesn't mean that everybody has to believe the same thing or hold the same opinion, right? So like, I think there's so much space right now for healthy dialogue if we hold that space. And it's hard to do, but it's worthwhile.
And before I ask you about the world that we're in right now, I really loved Dylan.
Oh,
and she was just really sweet. And, you know, again, read the book, y'all. Mm-hmm. But how did you always know Dylan would show up one day? Was it hard to make Dylan? Was Dylan always in the back of your mind?
Dylan is me, honey. Like, okay. As me as one can possibly get, but it's the stuff that I can't say online without getting canceled. So she says the things that I cannot say. When the first time we see Dylan, like, pop off, oh my gosh, it felt so good to write that paragraph. There's a meeting about the presidency, about the campaigning and stuff, and a character makes a comment and she just stands up and just, she goes in, not even directed at him. And it just felt so good to be able to say the things that I want to say, but through the lens of a fictional character. So, you know, because people be mad when I talk. So let me just give it to you through her. But know that I'm the one saying it.
And she was so unbothered. I loved it.
So unbothered.
I'm like, what are some of the characters that resonate with the kids when you're on tours? That are like, how do they experience the characters in the way that you intended, or do they experience them very differently, or a mixture of both? I'm so interested.
Now, the interesting thing about the Dear Martin trilogy is that most people don't really latch onto a single character, right? And that's been really surprising for me. Mm. They just love the world, and they are interested in all of the people in there. So they get attached to different characters at different points in the series. So as they continue to read, and it's worked in my favor because each book is following a different main character. So because people aren't just distinctly attached to Justice, they're willing to read Dear Justice, which is about Laquan, and they'll be willing to read Dear Manny, which is about Jerry, because they like the world. So I do think, though, that is going to shift a little bit once people start to meet Dylan, because Dylan is everything.
Bad girl.
She
Bad
is
girl.
My favorite character I've ever written, and I just love her. And I'm trying to resist the urge to, like, give her her own book. I need to do other things.
She really is that girl. What is it like to be a writer in this moment, or to have a book come out in this political moment that, you know, it's been dicey. You know, your first book came out in a moment that, I mean, that's why I met you, where we were the protests and da da da.
Yeah.
But this feels even more something. This moment.
I mean, it really doesn't to me. I think, and okay. I think probably, well, and it's likely because, like, I'm already banned everywhere. Like, what else y'all gonna do? You know what I'm saying? Like, there's almost a, like, I'm just going to keep doing the work. Y'all haven't liked the work from jump. So I'm just, like, this is nothing new for me. What I will say is that I can't wait to see if there are people who are unfamiliar with Dear Martin and Dear Justice, but who pick up Dear Manny because of the cover and who decide to read it, and who are not familiar with me, and they see Nick Stone and they assume it's a white guy, like, because there's a white boy on the cover, and how the reception, I'm interested to see how this is going to be received, especially in light of how the other two were.
You know, what I love about your work, too, is that it gives people language. Like, I think about the way you sort of deal with helicopter parents, or like and sometimes people know the experience, but don't have the language for it. And then I read this, I'm like, oh, this is good. Some kids are going to know what to say after reading this book. I wanted to know, too, what advice do you have? You have inspired so many young people to think about writing, and so many adults to also consider writing. Do you have any advice for young writers or emerging writers who want to follow in your footsteps?
100%. Listen, the main thing that I will say is that writing is about relationships between human beings. All storytelling is human, right? Even the books about trucks, cars, animals, all of those things, they're anthropomorphized, right? They have human characteristics, because we are trying to teach young children, with those books, we're trying to teach children about what it means to be a person, even if that's happening subconsciously. So if you want to be a writer, you have to learn how to be a human. And what that means is making sure that you are validating all of your very human experiences, right? Like not gaslighting yourself, making sure you feel your feelings, taking the time to understand the things that you find hurtful or harmful, knowing who you are. Like all of those things are super imperative. And then you also have to be willing, like there has to be a willingness to engage with things that you, number one, don't know, and number two, don't agree with, right? Like there's an openness necessary to create good stories. Cause like anybody can tell the same story over and over again. But to me, it's important to try to tell things in a new way if I'm going to achieve my mission of getting people to think critically.
Boom. And on that note, let's close with, so buy the book, y'all, because it's great. Buy all the books. But I wanted to know if you have anything to say to kids who right now are feeling heavy about the world. I think about in so many schools because of ICE or because of what's happening, people's hope is really challenged.
Yeah.
And I wanted to know what you say to those people whose hope is challenged.
What I say to people whose hope is challenged is to breathe. Deliberately. There's something to me about recognizing that my body is keeping me alive and participating in that, that makes me remember that nothing lasts forever. You know, like I have a friend named Michelle. I saw her on Monday this week, and she was telling me about how she was complaining to a friend about the state of the world. And the friend basically said to her, "That's cool, but just don't forget the sheer magnitude of insignificance. Like, the world is massive, and this time is what it is. And there have been times before it that were worse. Like, I like to say, like, my ancestors were enslaved, so this is light work, you know." Just being aware that there were times before this one, there will be times after this one, and finding that one thing that you can hold on to. And for me, it's my breath. Like I just literally will force myself to feel my breath going in and out of my body.
Boom. Everybody, the one and only, Nick Stone, get the book, Dear Manny, wherever you buy your books, and hopefully we'll get to see you on tour. Well, that's it. Thanks so much for tuning in to Bossy Other People this week. Don't forget to follow us at Cricket Media on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. And if you enjoyed this episode of Bossy Other People, consider dropping us a review on your favorite podcast app. And we'll see you next week. Bossy Other People is a production of Cricket Media. It's produced by AJ Moultrie and mixed by Vasilis Futopoulos. Executive produced by me, and special thanks to our weekly contributors, Kai Henderson, DR Ballinger, and Miles E. Johnson.